Serendipity, like innovation, is a buzzword. If you own a startup or any type of forward-thinking company, you're meant to be chasing it. That moment of unexpected realisation, of almost accidental discovery, has cultural capital in our digital world. And lots of people are committing considerable time and effort in trying to understand how you can make serendipity happen on a regular basis. I know that sounds oxymoronic, but the people we'll meet on today's Future Tense believe it's not only possible, it's also desirable. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Thanks for joining me. So harnessing the power of serendipity is our theme for today. But in keeping with the surprising, the unexpected, we're going to begin with a man who thinks serendipity, well, at least what he calls the myth of serendipity, is a load of nonsense. He's former MIT researcher Kevin Ashton, author of the wonderfully named book, How to Fly a Horse, The Secret of Creation, Invention and Discovery.
Serendipity has a very interesting origins story in that the princes of Serendip are characters in the tales of the Arabian Nights. And somehow their story a couple of hundred years ago got retold in English as if they achieved miraculous results almost by chance. Things sort of happened to them accidentally, and that was known as serendipity, the luck of discovery. But if you actually read the story of the Princes of Serendip, what you find is they're almost like prototypical Sherlock Holmes characters. They arrive at extraordinary conclusions through a series of deductive steps. They are prime examples of reasoning your way gradually to an amazing conclusion. So the results look miraculous, but when you actually look at it, the process is a series of steps, a series of relatively ordinary steps. So the reality of serendipity, the origin of serendipity, is also the origin of creative work. And the myth of serendipity, that there's this magical, fortunate flash of inspiration, is very much like the myth of creative genius. So, you know, the reality is, if you take a lot of steps and you continue even when you fail or something doesn't work or you reach a dead end, eventually you are more likely to reach an extraordinary conclusion than somebody who just gives up at the first pass. But you're also more likely to reach an extraordinary conclusion than somebody who kind of sits around waiting for lightning to strike, or thinks that if instead of working on their, you know, their screenplay or their painting or their invention, they go to a lot of parties and sit in a lot of coffee shops, that something magical will cross their path. You know, that's the myth of serendipity. The reality is you need to take a lot of steps, and the more steps you take, the more likely you are to succeed in the end. The thing about serendipity, this the mythical serendipity, the idea that magic will strike you if you're in the right place at the right time or something, is it provides a beautiful excuse not to do the work. And that's the destructive nature of that myth. It encourages us to do something that we kind of want to do anyway, which is slack off. And it creates this romantic gloss over slacking off. And, you know, someone will always throw out the anecdote of the one time somebody decided to go to a party and they met somebody and they started a band and became the Beatles or something. And I don't know, you know, how true those anecdotes are, but they're certainly very exceptional. So it is a problem. I mean, the reality is you have to do the work. You have to work very hard. And the more you work, the more likely you are to succeed.
Kevin Ashton, the author of How to Fly a Horse, The Secret of Creation, Invention and Discovery. So serendipity as some kind of magical force, well, let's put that to the side. But if you get the groundwork right and you create a conducive environment, can you put yourself in a situation where unexpected connections are made and what might be called serendipitous discoveries actually occur?
Serendipity is one of these inherently positive phenomena. It's something that can take people in new directions and can surprise and delight them along the way. And I think that serendipity is actually a really positive component to user experience. So if we can design to create opportunities for serendipity, we can improve their users' experiences with interactive systems in general.
Stefan Makri is a lecturer in human-computer interactions at City University London, and he spent several years researching serendipity and how to foster it in the digital world. But the problem is, according to Dr. Makri, that the search systems we use actually work against serendipitous discovery.
The CEO of Google said that he wanted to see Google moving from being a search engine to a discovery engine. But I think we're still working towards how to figure out how best to do that. I think there's been an assumption that when people want to find information, search is so good, so therefore we should go and search for it. But actually that ignores other key ways of doing that, like browsing and exploring. And so I think there really is a bias towards supporting search, and it's meant that supporting serendipity when finding information has been relatively neglected.
And that bias towards search then, you would say, would you, has actually limited our ability to be innovative or to discover new creativities?
Well, I think the bias towards search has made a couple of interesting research problems. It's made it interesting to try to figure out how we can help people when they're searching for one thing, how we can help them to discover other things that may not be completely related to what they're searching for. And I think that's the angle that a lot of people have been trying to take on supporting serendipity in search tools. But I think it's also opened up this other angle, wide open, of how do we support serendipity outside of search? How do we support exploration, perhaps by developing interfaces that allow us to visualize searches and allow users to explore searches visually rather than by typing in textual query terms. So I think it's been both a blessing and a curse that we've had this bias.
Now, you've been looking at, you and your team have been looking at ways to design serendipity into interactive systems. To many people, that will seem a very strange idea indeed. Explain how you go about that and what it means.
I think you're completely right that designing serendipity into interactive systems is a bit of an oxymoron, because perhaps once you design it into a system, it ceases to exist. So people that use the system might start to expect the unexpected or start to become immune to the value of the outcome. And so I think this is where there's a really interesting open line of research, trying to figure out exactly how we best support people to create their own opportunities for serendipity. So one thing we did as part of the Serena project that I was working on was we designed a mobile app, a semantic sketchbook, like a clever notebook that looked at the things you typed in and your images and then made suggestions for people that you might want to meet, places you might want to visit, new ideas related to what you typed in. And I think the main thing we learned from that was that you have to give users some control over the serendipity opportunities that you provide them. If you just give users serendipity on a plate, they might not enjoy the experience as much as when you created opportunities for them to experience serendipity themselves without handing too much to them.
So in one sense, we're not talking about developing a chance machine, if you like. We're talking about really helping to foster an ecosystem for creativity to occur. Is that correct?
I think that is correct. So that's the realization we got to. So once we designed this smart sketchbook app, this notebook, we then tried to look into, well, what is it that we need to do to try and create opportunities for users to experience serendipity if we're not handing it on a plate? And so then I kind of went back to the start and I interviewed some creative professionals. I asked them, is there anything that you do that you think increases the likelihood of you experiencing serendipity? And they told me a variety of different strategies, like varying their routines and being observant and relaxing their boundaries and drawing on previous experiences. So all of these were strategies where I think that if we design to support some of these strategies in search tools, well, in discovery tools, right, let's use a broader term, then we can help to create opportunities for serendipity. So the strategies that they think increases the likelihood of serendipity were things like making mental space, so stepping back, going for a walk, having lunch in the park, being observant, so really kind of keeping their eyes and ears open and regularly rehearsing their senses, relaxing their boundaries. So one person I interviewed said it's not just about relaxing your kind of discipline boundary, so being interested in information from other places that you might not normally look, in other areas you might not normally look, but also your physical boundaries, kind of exploring a little more in the world in order to be inquisitive. Drawing on previous experiences was another one. And so for each of those, I think there are important ways that we can design discovery tools that might create opportunities for serendipity. One of the big things we learn is that serendipity needs the person to take some action. And so we'd often heard about Louis Pasteur saying that chance favors the prepared mind. And so the notion of kind of preparing your mind with background information was quite familiar to us. But what we didn't expect was that you can also influence serendipity after the unexpected event has happened. So you then have to take some action to turn the unexpected circumstances into a valuable outcome. So one of the strategies that the creative professionals found helped them increase the likelihood of serendipity was seizing opportunities. But if you don't have the time to do that, then you might have to let a bunch of opportunities pass you by.
So in one sense, the fact that our world is so tightly controlled, that our funding, our budgets, our time is so tightly controlled, in one sense that can be seen as a good thing for accountability, but it may well also be a limiting factor, mightn't it?
You may have heard of Google's 20% time, where employees are allowed to spend part of their week just doing whatever takes their fancy. And I think that there's scope for all of us to, if we can, build some time in the week that's just unstructured time, where it's time where if some opportunity arises that we might want to put some investment into, we can make that investment.
You know, 20% free time and so on, so serendipity of time, you know, that companies like Google and the 3M and so on are giving to the employees. I mean, as long as it's more than rhetoric, and often, I suppose, you know, it is more rhetoric.
Sebastian Olmer is another researcher focused on fostering discovery. He's a professor for autonomy in art and design at the St. Joost Art Academy in the Netherlands. Serendipity, he believes, is a useful tool, but it risks losing its value when it becomes institutionalized by commercial interests.
What I am trying to do at the moment is to use the notion of serendipity to think through some of the deadlocks that I see at the moment that are preventing us from, having a sort of an open vision of the future, I suppose. So one way of doing this is to say, okay, this is serendipity. This is a notion that describes, you know, maybe not sort of exhaustively, but it describes in some sense the logic of, you know, innovation and invention. And so look at this and take it seriously, and then, you know, sort of scan our sort of infrastructural environment as we have it today, and, you know, look at how it's working. And what you will see then is that it's not, and that these things that we're talking about, disruption, innovation, creativity, are very much sort of determined by the logic of the market, by the logic of also, you know, technology and algorithms. And again, you know, these are not necessarily bad things, but they have to be integrated into really a culture of serendipity that is much more open and uses things like entrepreneurship and technology as means to a greater end. And that greater end is to create a, you know, sustainable and livable future. And we're not doing this at the moment. One of the problems of the neoliberal creed, you know, that has been around for the, you know, since the 80s, is that it's created an environment where it's very difficult to become, inventive in the sense that I'm talking about. I mean, to be honest, you know, the last like big example of this really is Silicon Valley. And now, you know, that seems like a paradox. But, you know, because what happened in Silicon Valley is that you had this convergence of two cultures of serendipity, really. On the one hand, the work that was done in the, you know, war and post-war research laboratories, and on the other hand, then in the 60s, the hippie culture. You know, and when these two cultures meet, they create something like Silicon Valley, which was new and which has really sort of, you know, changed our world. The thing is that we're now sort of, our imagination seems to be locked in this idea that, you know, whatever innovation is going to be in the future, it's going to look like somehow like Silicon Valley or will resemble it, which of course is nonsense. You know, it has to be something completely different. And unfortunately, I'm not seeing it at the moment.
Connections, I think, are fundamental to the way we think. And in fact, G.K. Chesterton said that thinking is making connections. And serendipity really is a process where you are connecting up to things that might not have had an apparent connection before. You've suddenly realized there is a connection between them and it may be significant. What we're trying to do with Honey is really build an environment where serendipity is a byproduct. I'm skeptical that you can build things specifically for serendipity, but what we hope is that serendipitous discoveries will emerge from the way we've built Honey.
Honey, spelled H-U-N-I, stands for the Humanities Networked Infrastructure Data Bank, a virtual laboratory that seeks to build new connections between different areas of the humanities. And Dr. Toby Burrows, now at King's College London, is one of its creators.
So what we've done is taken data from something like 30 Australian humanities data sets, in areas like literature, music, performing arts, and so on, and put all that together in a big pool. But what we've done is really deconstruct the data, if you like. So what Honey has is only the entities or the names of the people, the places, the organizations, the concepts that are present in those original data sets. So we've kind of stripped them out and put them into a database and then set it up so that users can either make collections of things that they think are related, those entities that seem to have some connection with each other, or users can actually build links into the database between individual entities. So they can say, this person is connected with this person, or this place is connected with that concept. I think that will build up into what's called a network graph of connections, of links, of trails that people subsequently can follow, and that will, as a byproduct, encourage those kinds of serendipitous discoveries.
And this is an open data project, isn't it? Is that important in this regard?
Yes, it is. All the data sets contributed their data on the understanding that this would all be open. Anyone can sign up to use Honey. You don't have to be an academic or a researcher necessarily. We're trying to reach beyond that kind of narrow community and try to build up, if you like, a network of relationships between things that are Australian.
Dr. Toby Burrows, and you'll find a link to the Honey website on our website. Just search the words Future Tense and RN. I'm Anthony Fennell, and today's program is all about serendipity. It's about setting the right conditions and environment for surprising and unexpected discovery. Honey is an open access project, as mentioned. Virginia Barber is the executive officer for the Australasian Open Access Support Group, and she has a particular interest in scholarly and academic publications and research. Now, echoing Stefan Makri early in this program, Virginia argues that many of the systems and practices we've developed in the digital world are no longer acting to foster serendipity and creativity, but are actively working against it. And she says we need to acknowledge that in order to make a change.
The internet was built to facilitate sharing amongst scientists, which I'd now include academics more widely. We've completely failed to build on that, I think, in a way that we need to. What we've done is impose a business model that worked on the basis of subscriptions, on paper journals, onto something that is potentially revolutionary. And it's quite bizarre to me that we find that an acceptable thing to do. I think the most important thing for me is that by not allowing seamless integration, sharing, we're really missing the whole opportunities that the internet affords. And every time you put a paywall in front of somebody, every time you actually put a need for somebody to log in, you're stopping people getting access in a seamless way. And it stops people who maybe are not sufficiently motivated to spend time. So for example, you know, students, if you've got people who are outside of institutions, the educated lay public want to be able to access information, journalists want to be able to. Right now, their information is very limited to the subset that they can easily access. And I think that we're missing an opportunity to involve a much wider community in research than we could possibly do. So in this context, there are two concepts. So there's the concept of being free and there's the concept of being open. So if something's free, say a PDF, a copy of an article, you can simply print it out, read it, and it's yours to look at. The difference between free and open is absolutely fundamental in this context. So open means not only can you read something freely, but you can reuse it because it has associated rights which are enshrined by licenses such as those developed by Creative Commons. So not only can you read it on the computer, but you can actually do what you like with that work. That's particularly important when you're thinking about data. So if you want to reuse data, it's absolutely no use just to be able to read it freely. You want to actually be able to look at it and to analyse it, download it, and share it around. And that's where openness absolutely comes in. So what do we have now? We have quite a lot of free literature, but what we don't have a high proportion of things that are truly open. And that's where the block comes.
So research will be better in an open environment, in a more open environment. Now, this program is really about serendipity. If you believe in the concept of serendipity, I presume you would say then that the more open the environment, the more chance that there is for serendipity to occur.
That's exactly right. So if you want to make something freely available, that's great. That's better than something being unavailable, but you're still limiting it to a sort of subset of people that can read it. The most interesting thing, I have to say, about what's happening in scholarly publishing now is it's not just the humans that are reading papers, it's machines that are reading papers. That's why these licenses are so important, because not only can humans understand and read them, but the machines can understand what they can read and mine. And so serendipity comes, I think, when anyone can have access to the information they need and to, you know, find unexpected things. And you don't get that if you only look at a subset of what's out there.
Keeping it free and open. Virginia Barber from the Australasian Open Access Support Group. We're going to end Future Tense today in Western Australia, in Perth, with an organisation called Space Cubed and its founder, Brodie McCulloch.
In the last few years, the term accelerated serendipity has been used around how can we structure a way through the co-working space with events, programs, and just the physical design of the space to create new opportunities and move ideas forward much more quickly. This is also done through digital technology, so often co-working space will have internal social networks. So it's the overlaying of the digital and the physical space with a range of different people offer the opportunity for new ideas to start up much more quickly.
Which may sound slightly confusing if you're used to working in a traditional form of office, but the sort of working environment that a company like Space Cubed offers is one in which interaction and face-to-face networking is encouraged by bringing different companies, organisations and researchers together under the one roof.
Co-working has exploded globally over the last 8 years, and I think it comes from a few bigger trends around, you know, the sharing economy, how people don't really need to have their own office space anymore, they just need access to space. Also around the way people can work now has changed dramatically with technology. You know, you can download an app and be renting out your room of your house and also or driving Uber. So that there's these bigger trends, and that's all coming alongside how the way people work has changed and the value of work has changed. So, you know, over the next sort of 10, 15 years, there's a lot more emphasis being put on creativity and how people come up with new ideas and can execute those more quickly compared to, you know, in the past it's been about accounting and legal and those, that's where a lot of value has been placed. So I think that change in those bigger trends has meant that co-working spaces are sort of great locations for people to start up their ideas and get the support they need.
Are there certain types of industries or are there certain people who benefit more from this model of office space and engagement?
We've got, so through Space Cubed, we've got a range of different companies and organisations and different backgrounds as well. But for obvious reasons, technology businesses can adapt to these sort of spaces really quickly where they can pretty much work from their phone or computer anywhere in the world. But we're seeing increasingly more what we consider traditional businesses using spaces like this, where they can see the value of having their staff accessing entrepreneurs and accessing that diversity of ideas, which, you know, they then hope will create new products and services or inspire them with new ideas to tackle their specific challenges.
So the idea is you create a space where people can come and work in an open plan environment, in a sense, and can intermingle with other disciplines and perhaps, engage with them and then benefit from that intermingling. But you also force the issue a bit, don't you? You have events to try and get people to get together and to work together.
Events are a big part of co-working spaces, and we have some really base events where people come in to breakfast, lunches and get to meet people. But then there's much more structured collaboration events such as hackathons, which usually run over a weekend, bringing together a range of people. Also, often they'll be focused on a specific industry or a specific problem. So GovHack is a good example of that, where you have 100 people who come in and will actually come up with new ideas using government data to serve citizens. We also have events around mining, so using mining technology and mining data to tackle some of the bigger challenges in that industry. But really it is all based on people with different backgrounds working together around things that they might not normally have worked on before.
And what about the actual design side of the space? You're not just providing an open area for these various people to come together in. You've actually got to put some thought into what sort of structure, what sort of design will work in order to foster innovation.
Yeah, so with SpaceCube, we went through about a six-month design process and a co-design process where we worked with the people who are going to be using the space to help design it. And that led to a very organic, open, you know, a lot of the feedback we had was people wanted some barriers but wanted to be able to work closer together, access different types of spaces for the different types of work they needed to do. But a lot of it actually came down to, yeah, how can people work alongside each other but then get access to, you know, different skill sets as they need. So the space that we built through SpaceCube has a range of different opportunities for people to work together and individually, also private spaces for meetings. But it's really through that development and through that process, members get connected to that space much more effectively. So
I would imagine that it would be very easy to get it wrong, to provide a space or to build a space that becomes overcrowded or noisy or where people don't feel like they're mixing with others, but that others are getting in their way. There would always be those kind of dangers, wouldn't there?
Yeah, and it's interesting though, we don't have a lot of rules around SpaceCube, or co-working spaces in general don't have a lot of rules. And what it really does is put back responsibility to the individuals who, you know, most of them are paying to be there. It's their responsibility to sort of, you know, they regulate their phone calls and they take responsibility for their actions. So I think that's a big part of it is, you know, it's about building a community of people who sort of respect each other. A lot of them are there for similar reasons to start up their ideas. So they all sort of understand that this space has been designed with them and it's about providing a platform for them to move their ideas forward. It's really designed to be as flexible as possible so they can come in month to month and start up their ideas, and then if that grows really quickly, they can move on. But what we've seen is people staying connected to co-working spaces. So once they move interstate or might move on to another job, they'll still stay connected so that they can still access the people, the mentors, and the potential for new ideas to develop from that space.
Serendipity in the digital age. It's about building a conducive environment and using technology in a smarter way. Brodie McCulloch there from SpaceCubed in Western Australia. We also heard today from Stefan Makri at City University London, Sebastian Olmer at the St. Joost Art Academy in the Netherlands, Kevin Ashton, author of How to Fly a Horse, The Secret History of Creation, Invention and Discovery, Toby Burrows from King's College London, and Virginia Barber at the Australasian Open Access Support Group. My co-producer on Future Tense is Karin Savanovitz, the sound engineer this week, Steve Fieldhouse. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time, cheers.